Hi there, we're going to go ahead and get started. Hey everyone. Well done, Bob. Excellent whistle. Hi, my name is Erin Blue. I'm the director of the Creative Writing Program at Florida State, and thank you all for being here tonight. Before we have the much beloved, esteemed, and delightful David Kirby to come up and read new poems for us, we're going to just take a minute to talk about the fact that we have changed the name of the reading series from the Warehouse Reading Series to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writer Series. Jerome Stern was a much admired and influential mentor to many, many people, including some of our own faculty, who taught at FSU for many years. He and his wife, Maxine, very generously left a gift to the Creative Writing Program, and in honor of that, we've changed the name to honor his years of teaching and mentorship and generosity toward us. Our chair in the English department, Eric Walker, who I believe taught with Jerry for a long time, is going to come up and just say a few brief words about Jerry and let you know what kind of wonderful person he was to help us bring this art to Tallahassee's community. So please welcome Dr. Eric Walker.
I've got David's poems here. I can rearrange them. It won't make any difference, is it? I know you're jealous that every second I spend here is a second taken away from dwelling in Kurdistan, so I will be brief. I'd like to welcome and a shout out to Baird Stern, Jerry's son, is here with us. If you can give him. The family, Maxine, Jerry, Baird, have been great supporters of the program and have done wonderful things for us. And it's entirely proper that we name the series after Jerry. 32 years ago, I was a 32-year-old rookie assistant professor at Florida State. It was my great good fortune at the time, I didn't know it at the time, John Fenstermaker stuck me in a terrible little closet of an office. And my great good fortune was that I was right next door to Jerry Stern's office. And this is what I heard from Jerry's radios, which are brief, a radio call, university. I was in the office reading term papers, chair tilted back, my feet propped against the edge of the desk. A knock at the door and a blonde, kind of heavy guy, early 30s, looking vaguely familiar, sticks his head in, smiles big, and says, "Hey, just thought I'd drop by. Say hello." It was a student who I hadn't seen in, I don't know, 7, 10 years or more. And when he said his name, I remembered his quick mind and the class he was in and some of the other people he hung out with. He tells me what he's been doing, went to the coast with a friend, got bit parts in cheapo horror movies, managed a fern bar, lived in Mexico, worked on a coastal steamer, got deadly ill, finally went to law school, married now with a kid. And I thought, here this person has been doing all this stuff all these years, and he finds his teacher in the same position he left him 7 years ago, feet on the desk, reading term papers. I thought about what that might mean and what he might be thinking, and should I worry about it? Was I one of those characters who seemed never to live, who worked for 40 years for the firm, never looking past their green eyeshade? What should I do? Get a ticket to Kathmandu, buy a monster truck? And then I thought, no, my obligation was not to become a Zen Buddhist in Colorado, then do stand-up comedy in New Jersey, get interested in welding, and finally take up large-scale sculpture out of wrecked car chassis. And not to have tempestuous relationships with a historic succession of people who would break tables, wreck cars, have to be dried or bailed out at frequent intervals. Perhaps it was my calling to do what I love, to read, write, talk about what I learned, think up theories to explain things, and keep my feet on the desk. You return to your college town, The stores you shopped in have vanished utterly. The bars you drank in have different names. The restaurants you ate in are law offices, and the houses you rented have been bulldozed. The university itself, though, should be the one place where the trees are as green as you remember, the buildings standing just where you left them. The halls should be beige. The posters should be tattered. The classrooms vaguely grimy. The students, scraggly, scruffy, smooth or sleek, but doing the same things, hanging out, talking on the steps, yelling from cars. And when you come to a familiar office door, you should be able to knock and have someone look up at you from a desk littered with what looks like was on it when you left several lifetimes ago. And that person should tilt his head back and say hello in that voice that meant something to you back then. And you can feel the pleasure that might come from staying in one place to think, to learn, to pass on what meant something to you a long time ago and what you came back to find. I still hear you, Jerry. God bless you.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Whitney Gilchrist, and this is Matt Wenzel. We'll be your fall host for the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series.
And I just want to remind you of a couple things. Please kindly don't smoke in the warehouse. Also, please silence your cell phones, pagers, beepers, Tamagotchis. And try not to get up during the reading, please. It won't be that long. You can hold it. And please join me in welcoming Dorothy Chan. She's going to be introducing our speaker tonight. Dorothy Chan.
Hi. So one of the things that I love most about David Kirby is the fact that he believes that poetry makes things happen. And well, David Kirby makes poetry happen. He does this a lot. His poems are both filled with and inspire impetus. I admire how Kirby can take a single image, such as a luxury dog walking down the street, musicians sensually pouring out their souls, a woman visiting the grave of a loved college friend. The list really goes on and on and on and on. Kirby is able to take this image and figure out and unravel its relationship to the rest of human existence. And he makes it look so effortless, but it's obviously not. I mean, he's dealing with all of this human existence, cramming it all into one poem, poems, human emotion and feeling, longing and desire, and humor into poems. And like the most interesting people, his poems are filled with contradictions. They're snappy, yet legato. Funny, yet emotional, even heart-wrenching. His poems play on the relevance of popular culture, yet they also pay homage to the great masters such as Keats and Shakespeare. And of course, this is just to say that David Kirby is one of the most interesting human beings I have ever met. And I think that's really an understatement. His long, beautiful sentences really travel. He is truly a light in this secluded writer's world because he discusses almost everything in his poems, and yet his work is not filled with a single ounce of pretension. In fact, I argue that he writes and he teaches exactly what poetry should be. David Kirby is the author of more than 24 volumes of criticism, essays, children's literature, pedagogy, and poetry. His numerous collections of poetry include The Haha from 2003, shortlisted for the Griffin Poetry Prize, and The House on Boulevard Street, New and Selected Poems, 2007. A finalist for the National Book Award and winner of the Florida Book Award and the Southern Independent Booksellers Alliance Award. In nominating Boulevard Street, the National Book Award Committee noted, digression and punctiliousness, direct movement and lollygagging, bemusement and piercing insight are among the many paradoxical dualities that energize and complicate the locomotion of his informed, capacious consciousness. Kirby has also won several Pushcart Prizes, the Guy Owen Prize, the Cade Dieter Award, the James Dickey Prize, the Brittingham Prize, and the Millennium Cultural Recognition Award. He has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment of the Arts, and the Florida Arts Council. His poetry has been featured in numerous anthologies, including several issues of Best American Poetry. Kirby is a member of the National Book Critics Circle. Since 1969, he has taught at Florida State University, where he has received several teaching awards. He lives here with his wife, the poet Barbara Hamby. David Kirby, everyone.
So are you ready for football season? Huh? The game last night. Heart attack, right? Listen, I had an amusing encounter with an administrator at our school back in May at the graduation. And it got me to thinking about the whole enterprise, how athletics went together and all the different departments worked together. Did I? It's on? It's on. Okay. Are you ready for football season? Okay, all right. So I ran into this guy who made me think about the school, and I wrote a poem called The Chronicle of Higher Education. As I am waiting to go on stage at commencement, I shake hands with a gentleman I don't know and tell him my name. And when he tells me his, and I ask him what his role is at the university, he pauses and his eyes widen in disbelief, and he says, "I'm the athletic director." And then, of course, I want to mess with him, so I point down and I say, here? The athletic director is certainly an imposing presence, unlike, say, German philosopher Martin Heidegger, who was shy and tiny and had a little pinched mouth as well as a lifelong aversion to meeting people's eyes. Yet he turned the world on its ear with his innovative thinking about such matters as being and time. Even as a child, Heidegger, quote, was the smallest, he was the weakest, he was the most unruly, he was the most useless, recalls a friend, but he was in command of us all. At my university, the athletic director is in command of us all, even the president. All the president does is raise money. All I do is write poems. And as to the philosophers, who knows what they are up to these days? Which is the most important? In 100 years, could be me. If the poems are good enough, though there are no famous poems about athletic directors. Then again, the greatest poems are about the littlest things, a bird for Keats, a flea for John Donne. Walter Whitman, the failed poet who couldn't hold down a job, wrote about Walt Whitman, the healthy comrade and invincible optimist. Did you know that Whitman wrote a 47,000-word fitness guide under the name Mose Velsor? A graduate student at another university discovered that on a microfilm that hadn't been digitized yet. Whitman suggests that we eat meat, mainly, and wear comfortable shoes, and he warns against inactivity. To you, clerk, literary man, sedentary person, man of fortune, idler, the same advice, he declared. Up! I wish more poets were as clever as the professors in the psychology department who were studying gratitude, so they had young men and women exchange gift certificates, although they switched the certificates unbeknownst to the participants, thus leading a young fellow to think he's giving a young lady a certificate from a bookstore, but really it's for acne cream. T.S. Eliot said there's good poetry, bad poetry, and chaos. But there would be less chaos if more poets followed the advice of Martin Heidegger, who told Hannah Arendt that he wrote, quote, with the calm rhythm of a man chopping wood in a forest. Making your own wood fires is not only exercise of the sort that Whitman would approve of, but also good domestic economy, since it is an activity that warms you twice, once when you chop the wood, and once again when you burn it. Same with poetry. Same with football. You do it, it's over. You do it again. Okay. Okay. So how's that sound now? Okay. You poetry lovers in the back, am I getting to you there? Okay, great. Okay. How many of you are new students, that is new in the 32306, undergraduate or graduate? Zero. That can't be true. Okay, one. Okay. Who is that? Who is that in the back? What's your name, sir? Okay, welcome. And I've got a poem that I've written especially, and apparently, only for you. And I'm going to read it at the end, so don't go anywhere. Thank you, Dorothy Chan. Thank you for making me somebody that I would like to try to be tonight. Thank you, Matt and Whitney. Thank you, Keith Kopka, for setting this up, our managing director. And thank you for creative writing director Aaron Ballou. And thank you also to the bookstore, which showed up with books. Is that right? Got books back there? Okay. Books for sale, actually. That's okay. What do you know? Yeah. Christmas is just around the corner. So are we taking cash, credit cards? You have one of those sliding, one of those old school things from like 1976? All right. Okay. Okay. Barter. Yeah. This whole evening, as you've heard already, this whole series is one big thanks to Jerry Stern. When I put up on Facebook that I was going to be here tonight doing this, the reminiscences began pouring in. Jerry left this earth, Bayard, it was 1996, wasn't it? 20 years ago this year, yeah. And it's still like, you know, he's just over my shoulder, and so many people feel that way. There's some advantages to hard living and to poverty. I hope you all strengthened up your moral character this weekend without power and learned to talk to each other and read by candlelight. But back in those days, faculty actually shared offices, and my first office mate was Jerome Stern. And Eric mentioned that I'd won a couple of teaching awards. Every award I've ever gotten was due to just sitting there and watching Jerry and just listening to his gentle, insightful, wise way of talking to people much like yourselves. So anyway, as you saw in that first poem, Walt Whitman says, "Up, and so do I." I'm going to read you the title poem of my book. It's called Get Up, Please. And here's where it got launched. A couple of years ago, I went to I think it's one of the top three concerts I've ever been to in my life. It's right up there with the Doors and yeah. Okay. As long as it's not better than I am, I'll just let it go. Yeah. But anyway, seeing the Doors in Fredericksburg, Maryland, and seeing Cream in Baltimore, they're probably right up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Thank you. 2 years ago here in Tallahassee, Florida, this is one of the top three concerts of my life. I know you all have posters of these two guys on your dorm room wall, so why do I even mention Shiv Kumar Sharma and Zakir Hussain? They're two Indian musicians. Sharma played the santoor, which is, I'll describe in my poem, it's one of the strangest looking instruments you've ever seen in your life. And Zakir Hussain played the tabla, the drums, and you can find both of them on YouTube, and especially Hussain, spelled Hussain, is described by many people who know what they're talking about as the greatest drummer in the world, and he just beats calfskins with his hands. All well and good, but when they performed, there was speaking of performance, there's apparently no end to this one, but yeah. I'm going to reboot. Anyway, there was a gesture. There was a gesture that these two gentlemen performed, whereas one would touch the feet of the other one, and obviously in some kind of act of respect, and the other one would kind of quickly gather him up and get him to stand up. And they would do this back and forth. And, you know, I knew kind of what they were doing, but I wondered about the context, the cultural background, and this sort of thing. So I thought, how am I ever going to figure this out? And the very next day, Barbara and I were on the road, and we stopped at a Days Inn in Tifton, Georgia, that was owned by an Indian woman. I thought, now I'm going to find out what that thing means. So this poem is called Get Up, Please. The two musicians pour forth their souls abroad in such an ecstasy as to charm the audience like none I've ever seen before. And when they finish, they rise and hug each other. And then the tabla player bends down and touches the feet of the santur player in an obvious gesture of respect. But what does it mean? I don't find out until the next day at the Econo Lodge in Tifton, Georgia, where I stop on my way home after the concert and ask Mrs. Patel, the owner, if she's ever heard of these two musicians or knows anything about the tabla and the santur, and especially the latter, which looks like the love child of a typewriter and a hammered dulcimer, only with a lot of extra wires and tuning posts. And she doesn't seem to understand my questions, that when I ask her about one person touching the other's feet and then bend down to show her, she lights up and says, it means he thinks the other is a god. My children do this before they go off to school in the morning, as though to say, Mummy, you are a god to us. And I look at her for a second, and then I surprise us both when I say, oh, Mrs. Patel, and burst into tears. Because I think first of my own dead parents, and then of little Lakshmi and Padma Patel, going off to their classes in Tift County schools, the one a second grader who is studying homophones, I see the sea, and the other of whom is in the fourth grade, where she must master long division with its cruel insistence on numbers lined up under one another with exacting precision, and then crawling toward the page's bottom as you, the divider, subtract and divide again and again, all the while recording on the top line an answer that grows increasingly lengthy as you fret and chew the tip of your pencil and persevere. Though before they grab their books and lunchboxes and pile onto the bus, they take time to touch Mrs. Patel's feet and Mr. Patel as well, assuming there is such a person. Later, my friend Avni tells me that you touch the feet of your elders to respect the distance they have traveled and the earth they have touched. And you say namaste, not because you take yoga at that little place on the truck route between the t-shirt store and the strip club, but because it means I bow to the light within you. And often the people being bowed to will stoop down and collect you as if to say, you too are made of the same light. Reader, if your parents are alive, think of them now, of all the gods whose feet you have never touched or touched enough. And if not your parents, then someone else. You know someone like this, right? Someone belongs to the mighty dead, as Keats called them. Don't you wish that person were here now so you could touch their feet and whisper, you are my God? I can't imagine Keats saying, you too are made of the same light, though I can see him saying, as he did to Fanny Braun, I have been astonished that men could die as martyrs for religion. I have shuddered at it. I shudder no more. I could be martyred for my religion. Love is my religion. I could die for that. I could die for you. My own feet have touched the earth nearly three times as long as Keats's did, and I'm hardly the oldest person I know. So let this poem brush across the feet of anyone who reads it. Poetry is my religion. Well, I wouldn't die for it. I'd live for it, though. Now you've heard a couple of times tonight that I'm supposed to be funny, so let me try to do that. I don't really think of myself as the funny guy. I think of the guy who uses all the tools in the toolbox, one of which is humor. But I'm also the lazy guy, and I'm going to tell you, so many of you are poets, and I'm going to tell you, give you some little time-saving tricks here. As much as possible, get people to write poems for you on Facebook, which is easy. All you have to do is throw something out there, and they'll supply the lines and stanzas for you. So a couple of years ago, I was stapling something, and I had that heartbreaking experience where you go ka-chunk like that, but there's no staple in there. You know, it just like ruins your life for about 15 minutes, right? So I put it up on Facebook. Stanzas and lines started coming in. So this poem is kind of like a Donald Trump tie. You know, it's made in China. It's outsourced. And it's the title is, Oh Well. It's delicious, your cheese sandwich. Just wonderful. Though there's something a little unusual about the cheese. A little off. And that's when you realize you didn't take out that sheet of paper that separates one slice from another. And now the only thing to do is take your whole sandwich apart, putting the tomato slices, the arugula, the avocado to one side, and separating the cheese and discarding that portion of the paper you haven't already chewed and swallowed. And then you'll have to put the whole thing together again and go into the kitchen and wash and dry your hands. And during that time, the wide receiver will have caught the pass in the end zone. The power forward will have leapt into the air and drilled the ball through the net. The chukka will have ended, and now the players are cantering about laughing, their mallets slung casually over their shoulders, and you will have no idea what has happened, whether the ball has been driven fairly through your or the other team's goal or blocked by a hook, a bump, a ride-off. Or you press down on your stapler, only to discover that it's empty, and it's been so long that you've had to refill it that you can't remember where the staples are, and then you do. There's a box of 1,000 in the drawer on the left. But when you open it, you realize that was in another desk in the house you used to live in, and that was years ago. You put on your pants and realize the button is missing. And these are the only pants that go with the shirt you're already wearing. And while it's easy to sew a new button on, you don't have one. And there are none in the little sewing kit you got the last time you stayed at a hotel. Which is not so bad, really, because someone has used the black and brown thread, and all that's left is the red and green. But the pants are too new to throw away, so you fold them and put them away, even though you know you'll forget and take them out 3 more times and say, huh, no button, before giving them to Goodwill, St. Vincent de Paul, the Salvation Army. Now you pick up that perfect apple, the one that's rock hard, it's shiny red, shot through with yellow and green, like every other great apple you've ever eaten, and you bite down, and rather than a crisp, exhilarating tartness, you end up with a mouthful of mealy crap. And you think, if I put that much hope in an apple, then imagine the real letdowns that await you, that open the door to an empty universe, one filled, so to speak, with utter despair and nihilism that destroy your happiness, convince you that life is a sham, a fraud, a hoax. At work, you hate yourself for wanting a snack from the vending machine, but you put your money in anyway, and you make your choice, and the spiral turns, and your snack comes halfway out of its dock and sticks there. And for a minute, you want to smash your head through the glass and bleed to death on the cashews, the pretzels, all the candy you see that's never sold in stores because only a starving person in a workplace would buy it. And then you think how stupid you'd look, how everyone who saw you before the ambulance came would take a cell phone photo that it would make its way into the social media and stay there for years. So you dig into your pocket for more change because now you're going to pay twice for your fruit pie, cheese crackers, granola bar, and your hand goes down past your keys, past your pocket calculator, all the way to the hole in the bottom. And that's when you remember, yeah, my bus fare fell through that hole this morning, which is why I had to walk to work, just as I'll walk home, footsore and hungry. Or you have a car after all, but it's raining, and your umbrella's in the back seat, and you can see your car from your office, and the windows are open. On the way home, you shift from side to side on the seat like a kid ashamed of her cold, wet diaper, and you stop at the store, and finally you get to the front of the line, and all your stuff's on the counter, and you reach for your buy one, get two free coupon, but you can't find it, and that means either you'll pay for all three or have to tell the cashier you actually never wanted even one of the damned things, much less three of them. You tilt your glass of wine to your lips while checking your Facebook messages, and it's empty. An hour into your movie, your DVD freezes, and you take the disc out and blow on it. Did you really think you could fix it by blowing on it? On the other hand, your car did start this afternoon. It got you home. So it works. So does your phone. And there's always basic cable. Animals like you. Well, animals like everybody, but at least they don't make an exception in your case. And you'll find someone someday. Mm-hmm. People are always hooking up with people they knew in high school. Why not you? There's always takeout. Mark Weingartner, you gave me that bit about the missing button, remember? Yeah. Yeah. Well, I did, which is a good thing, yeah. Who knew? Speaking of colleagues who help you with things, Ned Stuckey French and Elizabeth Stuckey French led me and Barbara to a man named Tad Pearson in Memphis, Tennessee. We were going up there, and they said, hook up with Tad. Tad is a guy who takes you around. He knows everybody and everything, and he takes you to all the places where all the musicians lived when they were poor. And just a wonderful man and a terrific guide. And as we were tooling around Memphis, we'd also been to Montgomery and been to Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald's house, the museum that was once their house, which is one of the saddest stories in literature. You know, you just kind of wonder what went wrong. And it's like what goes wrong with many people, literary or not, you just don't know, which makes it very hard to think about and very hard to write about. But, you know, as I said before, I'm going to give you a couple of tricks of the trade if you're in the poetry business, which is when you have something that you can't figure out, just pair it with another story, another big, juicy, gnarly story, and let those two kind of talk to each other, and you just sit back like a stenographer and listen to the conversation and write it down. In other words, if you ever have a poem that's trying to be more than one thing, let it be that. And for the rest of you who don't want to get into the high-risk, high-reward, high-stakes poetry game, let me tell you that there's actually some advantage to what I'm doing up here. People at parties and on airplanes say, so you teach people to write poems? And I say, no, I teach people to think the way poets think. And if they end up writing poems, that's fine. But to me, it's you know, it's just useful in that other sense. This poem is called All My Jellies. I'm riding shotgun as we tool around Memphis in Tad Pearson's 55 Cadillac, looking for the house where Johnny Cash lived before he hit the big time. And people are shouting, what year's that? And that thing is clean. And sometimes just, all right, or right there, right there. And I think, funny, nobody yells stuff like that when I'm in my 2006 Prius. What's the deal with old cars? Or any car, really? Dorsey Dixon wrote Wreck on the Highway in 1936, the year when Ford came out with a V8 engine and more people began to die all over the nation. More power, more uncertainty. More uncertainty, more art. You can cheat somebody with a car. Sam Phillips promised a brand new Cadillac to the first Sun Records artist to write a hit song, which Carl Perkins did with Blue Suede Shoes, though the car was bought out of Carl's royalties. Before Zelda Fitzgerald married, she rode around in the back seats of convertibles, and when she passed a group of boys known locally as jelly beans, she'd laugh, stretch her arms wide, and cry, "Oh, my jellies." She made a king of Scott, at least for a while. Together, they put flesh on the spirit of the era he would call the jazz age. And then it all went wrong. What happened? All we know is that Scott wrote in a notebook, I knew something had happened that could never be repaired. It was as though, having eaten from every tree in the garden, they turned to the one that was forbidden to them, and when they ate of it, they heard the voice of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. And the Lord God called to the man and said, "Where are you?" And the man said, "I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid myself." And the Lord God said, "Who told you you were naked?" In Paris, the Fitzgeralds meet Picasso, Cole Porter, Fernand Léger, John Dos Passos, Hemingway. Though when Scott kneels at Isadora Duncan's feet in a restaurant near Saint-Paul-de-Vence and she runs her fingers through his hair, Zelda throws herself down a stairwell. Later, she collects jewelry from guests at a party and throws it into a pot of boiling water, quote, to make soup, end quote. She tosses her clothes into a bathtub and sets fire to them, buys a gigantic gilt mirror, has a bar installed in front of it, and practices 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, to the parade of the wooden soldiers which Scott says later is engraved on every organ of his body. It was as though the Lord God said to him, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and to her I will multiply your sorrow, and to them both cursed is the ground. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth, and in the sweat of your face shall you eat bread until you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust shall you return. Where did Adam and Eve go when God drove them out of the garden? Genesis tells us only that they were farmers. So you have to imagine a little town with one stoplight, a store or two, and what else? Camels? Arabs? Were there even Arabs then? Maybe a policeman in a cart pulled by a mule. He'd go from hut to hut to make sure everybody was okay. He'd pull someone in if they coveted someone else's wife or livestock, or simply drank too much wine or beer, since hard liquor wouldn't come along for centuries. Scott Fitzgerald dies at 44. He'd given up drinking a year earlier, but collapses while eating a Hershey bar. Zelda outlives him by 8 years, but burns to death in an asylum fire while awaiting electroshock treatment, as much in love with Scott as ever. Years earlier, they'd rented an estate with enormous rooms on the Delaware River, and Zelda ordered custom-made oversized chairs and couches that made the people sitting in them look like children. One day, you're riding around in a convertible shouting, "All my jellies!" And then, like that, you're wearing a dress that hasn't fit you in 20 years, and your face looks as though it's carved out of wood, and you look like a doll someone propped up with a couple of cushions, and your feet don't even touch the floor. Tooling around Memphis in Tad Pearson's 55 Cadillac and looking for the house where young Isaac Hayes learned to play his grandfather's piano, it's hard not to think of all the wrong turns you've made and the ones you have to make still. On the drive up from Montgomery, there are billboards saying, God has a plan for you, my way or the highway. Do you know where you're going? Let's meet at my house. And there you are in your goddamn big car, as Robert Creeley says in his poem, I Know a Man, the poem Robert Haas would call the poem of the 50s. And you're in a rush. All you want to do is get safely down the road. Yet there's darkness all around you. So you say to your friend, what can we do? And he says to you, drive, he says. And then, for Christ's sake, watch where you're going. Shorter poem. It's got another trick in it, which is I've written more poems than I should probably lay credit to, in which I've divided myself into an older and a younger version. This might be one you undergraduates and beginning graduate students might have to think about for a while, because you can write about yourself when you were a teenager, when you're my age, but if you're 20, I don't know that you're going to get that much out of writing about yourself when you were 18. Might not be that much difference. It wasn't in my case, but there was a teacher in my high school that did me a world of good, although at the time I didn't know it. Her name was Mrs. Jones. And that's the name of the poem. In high school, I'd wander down to the home ec room after class because there were always girls there and something to eat. And Mrs. Jones, who always said the same thing every time she saw me, you're going to be a handsome man when you grow up, David Kirby. How did she know? She was 35, maybe. I was 16. Whatever became of home ec? It's now called Family Science, as if that were even possible. Also Human Ecology, which makes more sense, since ecology just means the give and take of life. I make the pie, you eat a slice, you thank me. Somebody should write an opera about high school. How many musicals have been set there? I see myself walking down to the home ec room The door opens and someone comes out. It's my young self, I think, but he's going the other way, so I can't see. And I want to ask if Mrs. Jones still teaches here, but he can't hear me either. There's the sign, though. This is Mary Jones. And there you are, Mrs. Jones, putting away the mixmaster and hanging your apron on the back of the door. I clear my throat so as not to startle you, but you jump anyway, and then you say, David Kirby, is that you? God, you're beautiful. How could I have thought you old? The girls made a pound cake, you say. Would you like a piece? It's fall, and there's a whistle on the football field. No, I don't want a piece of cake. I just want to look at you, Mrs. Jones. You say, call me Mary, silly. But I can't do that. You're a teacher. You told me everything I needed to know about women, though it took me years to learn. I want to take you to dinner. I want to make love to you, but I'm twice your age now. And besides, there's a Mr. Jones. I'd like to break his neck. I didn't mean that. You deserve to grow old with someone like yourself. I hope he's sweet to you. I bet he is. The light is creeping out of the sky the way it does this time of year, and it'll be dark before we know it. The athletes laugh and shove each other as they make their way to the parking lot. Soon there's just one car left. It's Coach Wilson's. We're playing Destrehan this weekend. They'll kill us. Still, Coach watches game film, draws his X's and O's. Maybe we'll win. Maybe we'll get lucky this time. Another car pulls in, and a man gets out. You look over my shoulder, Mrs. Jones, and your face lights up like the bonfire at the pet rally tomorrow before our boys take the field and lose again. I better be going, you say. And look, I'm 16. I can do this, I think. The door opens, and a man walks in. Are you David? He says. And when I tell him I am, he says, a girl's waiting. She asked me if I'd seen you. She wants a ride home. Thank you all very much. I'm going to read just two more poems. The one I'm going to read now is the last one in the book. And it has the difficult to spell and very pronounceable name of Gnursk, G-N-U with an umlaut R-S-Z-K. And here's the way it works. You know how when you tell somebody you've done something, they always have subtle ways of letting you know that you didn't do it right or you didn't do the right thing? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You know, where'd you go? I went to the Grand Canyon. Oh, you didn't go to Walnut Canyon? No, I went to Grand Canyon. Oh, you should have gone to Walnut Canyon. Much better. Not so touristy, you know. So anyway, after about the 143rd or 689th time this happened to me, I thought I need to write a poem about this, but I needed to write about a place I've never been to. In this case, it's Poland, and I need a specific place in Poland that I needed to write about. So I invented this city called Gnursk, G-N-U, umlaut R-S-Z-K. Now, those of you who are familiar with the finer Polish tourism websites will recognize a lot of language that's been cut and pasted and plagiarized into this poem. But that's just the way it has to be because I've never been there. And actually, when I finished the poem, I was feeling smug and proud of myself. I said, oh my God, what if there is a place called Gnursk? And I looked it up and there isn't one, but I bet there will be. Gnursk. When people ask where you were and you say, Poland, they always say, did you go to Gnursk? And you say, actually, I went everywhere but Gnursk. And they say, oh, you should have gone to Gnursk. The food there is terrific. And it's free. And it's served by beautiful naked people. And they give you money when you leave, and you think, why didn't we go to Gnursk? Nah, we went to Malbork, where we saw the castle of the Teutonic Order, the largest castle in the world, as well as the largest brick building in Europe. And then we strolled through Warsaw's old town with its alleys, squares, and cozy cafes. We admired the wealth of artwork, sculptures, and silverware in Krakow's Czartoryski Museum. And in the countryside, we were grateful for the pleasant landscapes, plentiful wildlife, and unique bird-watching opportunities. But we never made it to Gnursk, where candy canes grow on trees, and the canals are filled with lemonade, where roasted pigs wander about with knives in their backs to make carving easy. Cooked fish fall from the sky. Grilled ducklings fly directly into your mouth. The temperature is always 78 degrees. The streets are paved with pastry. There are no clocks. If you say you went to Germany or Italy or France, people always want to know if you went to Schnitzelkite or Benzolio or Wazoo-sur-Mer. And you say, no, we never made it to those places either. But I was with the one person I wanted to be with most, someone who loves movies and parties and books as much as I do. And even though it was a short trip, we made love 3 times. Or was it 4? Maybe it wasn't any at all. If we'd gone to Gnursk, we would have had wall socket sex, the kind that shatters the bed, blows out the windows, breaks the pipes in the bathroom, and floods the rooms below. Still, we had a good time. Or did we? What is love, anyway? In 1982, a dentist named Barney Clark became the first human recipient of an artificial heart. The night before the operation, the doctors asked his wife if she had any questions. And she said, yes, when you replace his heart, will he still love me? And the doctor said, yes, of course he will, of course, of course. Maybe we'll go to Gnursk next year or the year after that. Maybe as the evening softens and the afternoon turns to night, the people of Gnursk will look out their windows and wish they were us. I'm going to read one more, but I'll say thank you right now. There are things you couldn't have been doing, taking rotting food out of the freezer, chopping up firewood, calming the animals down, rebuilding life as we know it. I hope to be signing a couple of books after this is over, but when that's over, Barbara Hamby and I are going to go to fermentation. I'm going to open a tab, and if anybody wants to come and have a drink on me, I'd be glad to buy it for you if you are of legal age, and if you're not, I'll treat you to all the cherry cola you can drink. And now for this final poem that I wrote for the one person back in the room who needs it, though he might not have come over here with this in mind. As you've seen, this has been the poetry reading I promised you, but it's also been an exhortation to take chances in poetry and to take chances. Everybody in this room who has done something, and I'm thinking of Bob Butler, Barbara Hamby, Aaron Ballou, Mark Weingartner, all my colleagues, every one of these people has stuck their head up and had it slapped down. And then you stick it up again, and sometimes you get patted on the head or caressed on the cheek, and that could go on for years, and you get slapped down again, and that's just what you do over and over and over. So this poem is for a student who was here maybe, I'd be surprised if more than 3 or 4 people in this room would remember his name. It's an intimate poem. It's a tell-all poem, so much so that when I finished it, I said to Barbara, should I even put this out there? And she said, you have to. You're keeping this man alive. Poem is called This Living Hand, and the man's name is Tom Mannarino. Tom Mannarino defends his MFA thesis brilliantly. But when I stick my head in his office door to say so, he's slumped in his chair and staring at the door, and when he looks up, there's no other way to describe him than horror-struck. Tom's thesis is a novel about his escape from a crushing religion and the freedom he finds in the love of men. And now that it's written, and we're all telling him it's brilliant, he realizes he's at a turning point, that his story isn't academic anymore, that it will be published, and people will see it, his family included. It's so hard to connect with others sometimes. Keats wanted to. Leigh Hunt remembered that his young friend looked often at his hand when he was near death, a hand, quote, faded and swollen in the veins, and Keats would say it was the hand of a man of 50. And then Keats turned from one of those long poems he was no good at to write in the margin a fragment that begins, "This living hand, now warm and capable," and he ends, "See, here it is, and I hold it towards you." In Celtic theology, it's said that heaven and earth are only 3 feet apart. But there are thin places where the distance is even smaller. "The door between this world and the next is cracked open for a moment," wrote one mystic, "and the light is not all on the other side." When soldiers at the Battle of Little Bighorn realized the jig was up, they shook hands with one another. "Goodbye, Calhoun. Goodbye, Ross." And the Arikara scouts kissed their horses and told them they loved them. Tom, you try to live your life, but home calls you back. On a beautiful May morning, your parents are away. You mow the lawn, put the mower back in the garage, pick up the gas can, pour its contents over you, strike a match. Tom, it should be a better world. It isn't. Why didn't you just leave? 200 years ago in Philadelphia, wise men wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." Why couldn't you believe them? Jefferson had originally written, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." But Franklin struck the three words that made the claim religious, changing it to a claim based on reason instead. Tom, you weren't thinking, were you? Maybe religion could have saved you, though not the kind that says people who are different from us are evil. Paul McCartney was 14 when his mother died of cancer. Later, she came to him in a dream. "It was great to visit with her again," he said, and then he wrote "Let It Be," because in the dream, his mother told him, "It will be all right, just let it be." Keats's hand was faded and swollen, but his skin is clear now, his fever cooled. "Can you see? It's just here, Tom. He's holding it out to you. Take it."
Okay, let's give one more round of applause to David Kirby, please. Thanks, y'all, for coming. Please take your glasses and bottles back to the bar. And come next week, Whitney, who do we have?
So next week, we have the novelist Sam Ligon and Robert Lopez. Ligon, Sam Ligon and Robert Lopez reading at 8 p.m. Tuesday, right here.